those of you who haven't already heard this short introduction, you may be interested to know that the Swami joined the order in 1993 at Bourne End, England, the center near London. He then spent 5 years in India, 2 years at the training center, and 3 years in Mysore. He then took his sannyas vows, his final sannyas and vows, in 2006, and was posted to St. Louis, where he is an assistant minister to Swami Chetanananda, in 2007. He's been there the 12 years since, and it was his great grace to agree to come and do this weekend with us. This is the last of his 3 presentations, and he will speak to us this morning on the significance of worship. But first, as we all know who've been with him this weekend, he sings and plays the harmonium so beautifully, so he'll start us with a song.
Thank you. Krishna, though, it doesn't mention his name. Are we good now, Brother Shankara?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Is the microphone?
Yes, it is.
Patram pushpam phalam toyam yome bhaktya prayachati tamaham bhaktyupahritam ashnami prayatat manaha om shanti shanti shanti. Whoever offers me with devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or water, that I accept, the devout gift of the sincere seeker. Om, peace, peace, peace. So the subject is the significance of worship. When you read the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, you will come across one teaching again and again. Sri Ramakrishna reminds his listeners that the goal of human life is to realize God. It doesn't matter whether the listeners were his young disciples who would renounce the world, or his lay disciples who had perhaps big families. Thank you. But the message was the same for everybody, the goal of human life is to realize God. It doesn't matter where we stand in life or what we do. And we accept that. If we are followers of Sri Ramakrishna or somehow we have some belief in his teachings, we accept that as true, that the goal of human life is to realize God. So we accept it and we say, yeah, that is our goal. If anybody asks us, we say, yes, that is the ultimate goal of life. But in the meantime, we have many other goals, more pressing things. My car broke down. My immediate goal is to fix it. Otherwise, I cannot get through my day. So when my car breaks down, I forget all about Vedanta. I have to first fix my car. So that is a very immediate goal, fixing the car. But we have other goals that push aside this ultimate goal of realizing God. If you boil down all the many goals we have in our lives, you can boil them down to two things. We want to have affections, and that translates as a family or as friends. We don't want to be alone in this world. That is one goal. It's a human need. And the other goal is we want success. And that is can be prosperity or professional level, whatever it is, recognition from other people. So all the goals we have, if you boil them down, they can be reduced to these two things. We want to love others and be loved. And we want to succeed in whatever our interests are. Whatever is my interest, I don't want to fail. I want to succeed. So these two things take priority. And the goal that Sri Ramakrishna mentioned remains far away in the background. So all my energies are invested in loving others and being loved by others and being successful in whatever is my endeavor, whatever I like to do. So how to bridge this gulf between the ultimate goal and my immediate goals? For most of us, this ultimate goal remains in the background, far away. And these other goals occupy all our energy and time. Kabir has a beautiful song that says, Bita Gayedina, Bhajana Binare. So he says that our lives are passing in vain without worshipping God. And there's one line, Lahi Karana Mula Gavayo. I don't know Hindi, but I know some songs. So if you say something in Hindi, I won't understand, but I can quote from a song. So he says, it's very poetic. One way to translate it is that taking the interest, we lose the capital. So this is some language that we can understand. That's not very smart. We are very eager to collect our capital, our interest. And in the process, we lose sight of the capital. It just goes away. What is the interest? Secondary goals. Imagine all the things that we gather along our lives, from our childhood until old age. We are gathering things. We are creating relationships all the time. We are gathering possessions all the time. This is the interest. With my life, I am getting these things. What is the capital? My life. So Kabir says, taking care of the interest, we lose the capital. In the end, all the interest is gone. We leave this world. All the things that we gathered all through our lives are left behind. And the capital is gone too. the life that was given to us is a gift from God, that is also gone. So we have to keep sight of the capital, and the capital is all we really have, this life, the time on this earth. And the things we gather, yes, that's very good, but they will go. They are with us only for some time. Then we have to part. So it's important to bring into our lives this ultimate goal, to somehow keep our focus, at least partially. We may not be able to be thinking of these higher things all the time. We have other things to do, other obligations, our other desires to fulfill. That's fair enough. If you have a desire, fulfill it. There's no problem with that. But Sri Ramakrishna used to say, do this as well as that. In his very aphoristic language, he used to use very few words. Do this as well as that. And when the time comes, you can do that only. So what did he mean? Do this means do the things of this world, take care of your affairs. That's fair enough. But do that as well. That means think of God. Don't lose sight of the ultimate goal. When the time comes, you can devote yourself to the ultimate goal only. Somewhere else he said, hold on to this world with one hand and with God with the other. When the time comes, you can hold on to God with both hands. If we have a family, we cannot say, no, now I'll meditate. I won't fix dinner. You can say that. If the kids are waiting for food, you have to fix dinner first. So like that. So we have to gradually get used or train ourselves to bringing this new dimension into our lives. We heard that Sri Ramakrishna says that the goal of human life is to attain God, to become illumined. I didn't know about that before. Now I know about that. What am I going to do about it? Now that I know, is everything going to go on as usual without any change? Then there is little benefit in knowing about it. I didn't know before. Now I know. What's the difference in my life? Just knowing won't make much of a difference. So I should be able to introduce some changes in my life to make that knowledge fruitful. That, yes, I know the goal of human life is to realize God. Hence, I'll introduce these changes in my life. So there are many ways to do this. In Vedanta, we have a lot of freedom to pick and choose what suits us. We can, as we mentioned yesterday, follow Raja Yoga, the path of self-control and meditation, or Jnana Yoga or Raja Yoga, working for others, or Bhakti Yoga. So worship, today's subject, is more connected with Bhakti Yoga, or the path of devotion. For some people, worship is the main spiritual practice. Temperamentally, they really like to worship. I have seen devotees and swamis alike who they really love to worship. I seen one swami, 4 o'clock in the morning, before meditation, he wants to wipe the marble floor in the shrine and then polish the vessels for puja. That is before meditation. Most swamis will first meditate and then work. But he finds so much joy in doing this work for the Lord that that's the first thing he does. Polishing the vessels and cleaning the floor and making ready for puja, then he sits for meditation. And one of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples, Swami Ramakrishnananda, his main sadhana was worship, ritualistic worship. And he, for instance, in the summer, he used to be in Chennai, such a hot place. At night, it gets very hot. It remains hot, I should say. So he would fan the image of Sri Ramakrishna in the shrine until late at night. Now, why would he deprive himself of sleep to fan an image? it doesn't seem very reasonable. But for him, it is his spiritual practice. He feels Sri Ramakrishna's presence in that image. Is God himself. So for him, it is like a meditation. So there are such people for whom worship is the most important discipline. So if we want to talk a little about the history of our worship, which we call puja, we could say that it all started in the Vedic period, something they used to call yajna, or sacrifice. For the yajna, they had to have a sacred fire. And in the fire, they will offer their oblations. Agni is the fire, so Agni is considered the mouth of the gods. So when you pour offerings into the fire, you're offering, like feeding the gods, is the mouth of the gods. That offering, the subtle part of that offering, goes up to heaven, reaches the gods, and the gods, in exchange, will give you blessings and grant boons, etc. The belief was that human beings cannot offer to God directly. So fire was the intermediary between the human world and the divine, the world of the gods in heaven. And also there was no image worship during the Vedic period. They used to use pratikas, that means mental images. For instance, for concentrating the mind during the yajna, they would meditate on the radiance of the sun or the vastness of the sky, that kind of thing. So they are mental images, not material external images. Then when we come to puja, there is a shift, especially with the Gita, the teachings of Sri Krishna, the verse we just used as our opening prayer. Sri Krishna says, whoever offers me with devotion, I accept. Even simple things like a glass of water, I will accept. So God is telling, human beings can offer to me directly. You don't need Agni. You don't need the fire as an intermediary. So there is a shift. And now human beings perform puja to God directly. Fire is not a must. And another difference is, there is an image. It's called vigraha. That means that we can grasp the reality. We cannot grasp what is timeless and formless. We can't think of that. So to be able to anchor our mind to something that reminds us of that ultimate reality, we have an external image and we worship that. So these are the two main differences between the modern puja and the ancient yajna: the fire and the image. So there are, broadly speaking, two types of pujas, two types of worship, with desire and without desire. With desire, what does it mean? If you go to India, you'll find so many types of rituals for so many types of aims, results. If a couple cannot have children, they go to the temple, to the priest. There are some mantras, some rituals. Then they hope to have children. If there is a lawsuit and somebody is in trouble, go and worship such a god and then you will win. So it's endless. If somebody is sick, then worship this, say this mantra and you will get over it. Somebody has mental problems, oh, do this, do that, and you will recover. So there is a fix through puja for all the ills of life. And the scriptures do not condemn this. It's not condemned. When you read the Gita, Sri Krishna says very clearly, Chaturvidha bhajante mam jana sukriti norjuna arto jinyasurarthati jnani cha bharata shapa. That means four types of virtuous people who worship me: the afflicted, the seeker of knowledge, the seeker of enjoyment, and the wise. But the key word here that Sri Krishna uses is Sukritina. That means noble-minded. That means virtuous people. So if you see the four types that Sri Krishna mentions, one is the afflicted, somebody who has a problem and worships God. One is seeking knowledge, wants to know about God and worships God. One is seeking artha, or wealth, to enjoy this world. And one is the wise. So out of four, three have desires. I want to be cured of my illness, I want to know God, and I want to enjoy the world. Even though they have desires, Krishna says about all of them, they are noble-minded. He never says, hey, you should not worship me with an ulterior motive. He says, they are all noble-minded. But the sage worships without desire and is closest to him, he will say in a later verse. And if you think about it, it makes sense. We are God's children, aren't we? If we are God's children and we are in trouble, to whom shall we turn? A child falls down and hurts himself and then runs to the mother and says, Ma, it hurts. We do the same thing with God. We are hurting, we turn to God. So there is nothing wrong with that. But there is a higher type of worship too. So hopefully this lower type of worship, that I worship God because I have a problem, so I am hoping to get something out of him. It's a kind of exchange, that I'll give you this and you give me that. Even in Ramakrishna's life, there are incidents of that. He says in the Gospel, I vowed to worship the Divine Mother with coconut and sugar, if Keshab recovers. So he's changing a little the order of things. Instead of first offering and hoping that he will recover, he says, if he recovers, I'll offer. So only if he recovers, then I will give you this. He's trying to cajole the Divine Mother to cure Keshav. But it's the same idea. So even the avatar has done that. But this is the lower type of worship. Hopefully it will lead to a higher type of worship that is desireless. That means I don't want anything from God and still I worship God. In our special worship, probably you have this Durga Puja here, or Ramakrishna's puja once a year. That puja is more elaborate than the daily puja. And there are many steps in that puja. Towards the beginning, there is something called sankalpa, resolve. So you sit in virasana, a special yogasana, and you keep some items in your hand, like a banana and some Ganges water, etc. And you say some mantras, and that is the resolve of what you are going to do and what you hope to achieve through this worship. And there, so for instance, he will say that on such and such a day, in the company of the devotees, I will worship such and such a deity with such and such items. And then it says, and the purpose of this worship is, and it is mentioned, what is the purpose of our worship? So in our tradition, in our puja, we have a twofold objective when we worship. The first one is to enhance God's glory. Now you may say, God doesn't need our help to enhance his glory or her glory. Right? So what does that mean, to enhance God's glory? It means if I worship in the privacy of my home, then it remains there. But if I worship in public and I invite everybody, they will come, they will benefit from that holy atmosphere, they may bring their friends, they go back home with those holy thoughts. That is how spirituality pervades society. You bring spirituality to society through these public worships. So to enhance God's glory means I am proclaiming my devotion, my worship to God in public and inviting everybody to take place. So in that sense, it is done. To spread God's influence in this world, we worship God. So that is not selfish. We are trying to spread the word of God through worship. And the second objective is to develop love for God, myself, and whoever is witnessing the worship as well. So this is the twofold objective, to proclaim God's glory and to increase my love for God and whoever attends the worship. And then at the end of our worship, there is another step that we do. We offer the results to God. So whatever is the result of this puja, I offer to God. But how come I had no desire? Then why should I offer it at the end? If to begin with I said I have no desire of my own, then why am I offering to God and saying the result is for you? Well, you know, there are desires and desires. Some desires I may not even know I have them. They are subconscious desires. So I'm telling to God, look, even if there is some desire that I don't recognize consciously, even that you please take. I really don't want anything from this. I really want to give you the results. Conscious or unconscious desires, please, I don't want it. You keep the result. So this is the two types of worship, with desire and without desire. So there are some considerations that we can mention regarding the worship. We talked about the objective. Then the time or the type of worship. There is something called Nitya Puja, something that we do daily. I don't know the Indian people in this country whether they do Nitya Puja. I don't think it's very common here. In India it's more common that people will perform puja daily at home. Many people do that. But in this country people are so busy, and if you're in a cold climate, where will you get the flowers? And, you know, it becomes difficult. Can you get the flowers all year round here in the garden in Atlanta? No. So in the winter you're in trouble. In India you can have flowers all the time. Most of India.
Farmers market.
Yeah. So that involves going in the car, parking, buying, coming back home, and then starting the puja. Of course, you come. You know, some people buy once a week. That is true. And then you keep it somewhere cool in the house and you use the flowers as you need them. So Nitya Puja, and then you have Vishesh Puja is the special puja that we do once a year. It is according to the lunar calendar, so every year it will change the date. Then you have the place. Say you want to perform puja at home. There are people who, even Western devotees, who perform a simple worship daily. They will not tell you about it. This is their private practice. So they may burn some incense and offer some cookies with a glass of water. It's a kind of Western style offering. And some flowers. And that is their little worship daily. And it is, you know, Sri Ramakrishna used to say, the less people know about your devotion to God, the better for you. So that's why people keep it quiet. They don't talk about their personal worship. But as a Swami, we hear these things. Sometimes people tell us, I do this or I do that. So there was a lady who told me her story. She had a great desire to worship God daily, to offer something simple, but she felt that it will help her in her spiritual life. But at the same time, you know, she's busy with her job, she has to travel, and she was thinking, well, if you do something daily, then you cannot say, I'm going to Florida or I'm going to, you know, California, and so I'll see you when I come back. You know, that's not the way it's done. So she had this conflict. She has a strong desire to do this every day, but she knows she won't be able to do it in her shrine at home. So she approached her guru with this problem. And the guru said, don't worry, you can do it daily. And what you do is when you come to the hotel and you just sit quietly and do the same worship mentally. You offer it mentally. So that was the guru's solution. But this devotee was not satisfied. She said, I can't trust my mind that I will sit and I will do the same thing mentally because the mind is restless. Maybe the first day I will do it, the second day, maybe the third day, it may be a mess. So she didn't trust her own mind that she will be able to go through the whole thing with the same, you know, in the same spirit mentally. So then, in the end, the solution they found is she made a portable shrine with, you know, a small glass and a bucket of cookies. And so that is her mobile shrine that she takes wherever she goes. Just a small box in her, you know, doesn't need to take a lot of space, just a small box. And when she goes to the hotel in the morning, she opens the box, sets up the altar, makes her usual offering, sits for meditation, then closes the box until the next day. So it is possible to do. We have to make some adjustments. So she was very happy. She told me she had been doing it for a long time. We can make adjustments to make this Nitya Puja, the daily worship. But, you know, it all started with a strong desire. We have to have a strong desire. Then we are willing to pay the price of carrying this box in all our travels, etc. Another lady told me that she offers, a Western lady, she offers to Mother Kali some cookies and water every morning. Then I asked her, what do you do when you're traveling? And she said, oh, I have a picture in my wallet, and that is for my travels, and I do the same offering. So, you know, whatever, God looks at the spirit of with which we do it, the devotion with which we do it, not so much the formalities of formal worship and mantras and all that. Then, of course, when we do this worship, there are certain mantras and mudras that we use, especially in the Vedanta societies, and these are very strict. If we are going to do them, they should be properly done. If not, better not to do them. That's also fine. But to do something wrong, that is, you know, that is not right. If we want to learn mudras, then we should learn it properly. Once I went to a devotee's house, he was performing arati. He had invited us, and he was doing the arati anti-clockwise. And he was Indian. No, this is not normally done. It's always clockwise. So will it be inauspicious for him? I hope not. I don't know. But that's not how we do it. So if you want to do something, learn to do it properly. If not, just bow down and say your prayer. That's what I mean. So it is okay if we want to make it a little more elaborate. We should approach somebody who knows and learn the proper way to do it. There is a book on worship of Ramakrishna, for instance, for our tradition. And there it is nicely explained, but we need somebody who knows about it to explain whatever is not clear, etc. And then there is a mental aspect of puja, and that is very important, what we feel mentally when we are worshipping. One of the differences between the worship, ritualistic worship, and the teaching of the Upanishads, for instance, is that when you are worshiping, there is a positive attitude to sense experience. What do I mean by that? You will find in the scriptures generally that they say, turn away from the senses, right? The Katha Upanishad says that God has created the senses defective. So they only look outside. The eye wants to see, the ear wants to hear. So that is kind of described in a negative way. The senses are defective, they only look outwards. We should turn our gaze inwards to realize our own self. But in puja, in worship, there's no problem with sense experience. The eye wants to see, it will see the image of God. The ear wants to hear, it will hear the mantras or the bhajan, the devotional singing of God. The tongue wants to speak, it will repeat the name of God, or it will taste the prasad. So I want to smell, I'll smell the fragrance of the flowers that are offered, or the incense. So all the senses are engaged, but there is nothing wrong with that. Instead of becoming a hindrance, they become a help. The very same senses that would have distracted me, taken me away from God here and there, now they're helping me to focus my mind on God. So that is one aspect of puja, that sense experience becomes a help instead of a hindrance. Another thing that is very interesting in the context of worship in Vedanta is a positive attitude to ourselves. There's a famous utterance, Devo Bhutva Devam Yajet. Nobody knows the source. I have asked many Swamis. Though it is so well known, nobody knows where it comes from. So the Rishi who said this didn't want to be known. We don't know who uttered these words. But it means becoming divine, worship the divine. First we have to become divine. Then we worship the divine. What does that mean? You see, we are creatures. We worship our creator. But being a creature doesn't mean being a sinner. I'm a creature, that doesn't mean I'm a sinner. So I'm a creature, I worship my creator. But the idea is, to worship effectively, first I have to think of myself as divine. And there is a whole process to achieve this. Meditations and mantras. So these are preliminary steps in the formal worship. This is not something that we do like a daily worship at home because it takes longer. Or you may do it in a very abbreviated way. But when we do it here on special days, it takes quite a while to go through these preliminary steps. In fact, it takes most of the time. The puja itself is comparatively short. So there's a nice Bengali saying, Doshe Gune Manush. That means a human being is a mixture of virtues and shortcomings. When we sit to worship God, we should forget all about our shortcomings. And we should think of ourselves as divine. We are children of God, we are perfect. Because here is the idea. Before I can worship God, I awaken the divinity within me. This is the philosophy of Indian worship. So I awaken the divinity within me, bring it to my heart. So I need to be pure. I need to feel that I am divine. Then from my heart, I transfer, it's all done mentally with mantras, I transfer it to the image outside. Then I worship the image. And at the end of the worship, it comes back into my heart. So to be able to awaken the deity within me, I should feel I am pure. I am divine. So that is what Swami Vivekananda said. Each soul is potentially divine. The goal is to manifest that divinity. Somebody gave me a t-shirt with that message. Each soul is potentially divine, Swami Vivekananda. So I gave it to somebody else, some other devotee, because I don't wear this kind of thing. So then he came after a couple of days and said, thank you for the t-shirt, it's very nice, but I would introduce a little change to it. I would underline potentially. So we are potentially divine. We have to manifest it. So there is a lot of stress on purity when we do our worship in the Vedanta tradition. Everything has to be perfect and pure. But at the same time, we shouldn't get carried away by it. When I was in India, I was a pujari in the temple in Mysore 3 years. So in the south, or throughout India, they are strict about the purity of the worship and the temple. In India, in the south in particular. And so I was a newcomer, and I knew some puja, but I had to learn now the traditional way, how it is done in India, in the south. So there was a young novice, and he was my teacher. He was the pujari who was going to I was going to replace. So he was very particular, because he was a young man, maybe inexperienced, so he was very particular about these things, that everything has to be, perfect. So, for instance, your body is considered impure, because it's a material thing. So you are cutting the fruit, or you're arranging the flowers, you cannot scratch your head and continue. That's 100%, it's shocking. It's shocking that you should scratch your head and then continue touching the flowers. No way. Because your head is impure, your body is impure. You cannot touch anything. If you touch, you wash your hands. Then you continue. And so he trained me, and I learned it, and I was doing everything right. So then one day it was a special day. We had to garland some pictures up high up on the wall, and somebody brought a stepladder, and he told me, "Okay, now you can go up and garland, take the garland and go up." So I was going up the ladder, and he said, "No, you shouldn't touch the ladder, because you are putting your feet on the rungs." And I say, "How am I going to go up?"
You hold the side of the ladder.
So what I did is like this. But I was thinking all the while, if I fall, that's the end of the worship. I mean, that's the end of my life. I thought that was a bit extreme. Common sense. You're going up the ladder, safety above all. So the point of the story is we shouldn't take it to unreasonably extremes. Yes. It's good. At the same time, knowingly, we shouldn't make a mistake that, out of laziness, I will not go and wash my hands. I know it's wrong. I should go and wash my hands and feel that I have done the right thing, the way I was trained. I'll tell you another story. Because for Westerners, is a new concept that we have to do these things. We don't know. It's entirely a new idea. So when, long ago, when I was at the Vedanta Society, very early days, I was staying for some days, and I was put up in a room, and then the Swami told me, it's better if you move to that other room at the other end of the corridor. I said, fine, no problem. Gather my things and go. So I was gathering my few belongings and moving to the other room, and I was very unlucky, because as I was coming out of my room, the Swami came to see, and I had my sandals with the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna in the same hand. That's the most shocking thing you can do. He was frozen. He froze. He just could not believe it, that anybody would put, it's like putting the Bhagavad Gita and your sandals, holding them together. Because the feet are, of the body. If the body is impure, the feet are the worst. The farther you go down, the worse it gets. So that you should put your sandals together with the gospel. So he took the gospel and gently hit me on the head with it, but in a way that I will understand. So this is Vedanta. Boom, boom, boom. Then I understood. I shouldn't do that. But for a Westerner, it's a book and it's a pair of shoes. It's matter. It's matter. It's a glass, a clock, a pair of shoes. What's the difference? But I have to tell you, after so many years in this culture of being a Swami, I'm brainwashed, you can say. You know, I just couldn't do that. I mean, I couldn't put the gospel and the sandals together. It's just impossible. It's just impossible. So there is beauty in it. There is you can understand the meaning of it, but we should avoid extremes of being impractical about it, and also we shouldn't make mistakes knowingly. Through ignorance is fine, because God will forget us, will forgive us. You know, he said, Sri Ramakrishna said, a child calls the father, father. Then the younger boy calls him daddy. Then the smallest child calls him da. But the father knows he's calling him and saying da. He cannot say any better. He knows he's addressing him. He will not mind. So in the same way with us. We are trying to call on God. We make mistakes. But God knows. We mean well. Our intention is good. We are only trying to come closer to him. In our own imperfect way. Another thing that we could mention is that this sense of sacredness with the offerings, with the whole idea that suppose I offer a fruit or a flower, it is something very ordinary. I can buy these things in the market for a few dollars. It's nothing special. But when I offer them to God, they acquire a new dimension. They become special. In the Uddhava Gita, Sri Krishna says that herein lies the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the intelligent, that in this life, in this world, through finite mortal means, they achieve me, the immortal, the infinite. So that is cleverness. We are using very ordinary things like a water, a fruit, a flower, and we achieve immortality. We achieve God. We have an endless result, infinite result. So whenever we offer something, whenever we do something, it has two dimensions. Say, for instance, I am sweeping the floor. So it has one ordinary dimension that I want to clean the floor, and the result is, when I finish, the floor is clean. But there is another dimension. If I am doing it for God, then not only the floor will be clean at the end of it, but something will happen to my mind. I wasn't just cleaning the floor. I was doing it for God. So I get the floor clean and something else. There is some result in my mind because I was doing it for God. So this is what happened with puja. We offer ordinary things, but they are for God. They acquire a new dimension. Tagore wrote a nice piece on sadhana. And there he talks about these things. He says that a flower has two dimensions. One is out in nature. What is the function of a flower? Pollination and producing new fruits and seeds and new plants. That's the function of the flower. In that sense, the flower is a slave. Whether it is sunshine or rain, it will be doing its job. The flower has a job to do in nature, and it's doing it clockwork, as it is expected to be done. But then the flower has another dimension. A human being sees the flower and sees the beauty of it and appreciates that. Not only that, a human being is willing to pay for it, keep it at home, knowing that in a couple of days it will be gone. We are so practical in our ways. We won't waste our money on something that we know after a couple of days we have to throw away. We cannot eat it, we cannot... Why do we buy flowers? To enjoy their beauty, their fragrance. There's no other reason. We know we'll throw them away. We cannot keep them forever. So Tagore says, this second dimension is a divine trait, that to be able to appreciate this beauty of a flower. And he gives a beautiful simile. He says, when Sita was abducted by Ravana, she was imprisoned in Ravana's palace. And so Ravana would appear to her in different guises to try to trick her to marry him. And she would refuse every time. Then Rama said to Hanuman, go to Sita and tell her that I'm here, I'm alive, and I will come to rescue her. And show her this wedding ring so that she knows that you are Hanuman, you are not Ravana. So Hanuman goes to the palace and conveys the message to Sita, showing the ring. And then Sita knows that, yes, this is a message from my beloved. It's a true message. So Tagore says, a flower is like a message from God to us. We are like Sita in this world. The soul is imprisoned in this world. And this, the beauty of a flower is reminding us, it's like a message from God, telling, I am here for you. Don't worry. I know you are there. I am here. So I think it's a beautiful analogy. The flower gives us its beauty only. So in the same way, when we do puja, it acquires a different dimension, a deeper dimension. It's not just like anything else we do. We are doing it for God, so it's something special. Well, I don't know whether you would like me to continue talking and talking and talking, or do you want to do some questions and answers? Because it's 12 o'clock already. So if anybody wants to ask some question.
The preliminary steps that you said in terms of preparing the mind,
mm-hmm.
the very first one that you said was the mantra and meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Invariably, mantras that are given as such make no meaning, but still they are called bijas.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just...
Yes, yes, yes.
How?
How
that it just... Is it just... Not take our mind into meaning state or searching meaning?
I don't know. The answer is I don't know. But I can tell you my thoughts. The bijas, they are specific for specific deities. So Kali will have a bija mantra, and Rama will have another, and Krishna another, etc. Ganesh another, Ramakrishna another. So the bija mantras are very specific for each deity, and they are esoteric. Esoteric. They have been discovered by the rishis. Okay? They are revelation, you can say. They are revelation. So a sound is linked to a deity through revelation. Some rishi experienced that this deity was linked to this sound. And that's all the meaning there is to it, because it's revelation. So it's not something that has a grammar or has a... The source is revelation, the source of the bija mantras. So they come from ancient times, and that's all we can say about it. Why a certain bija is for Krishna and why a certain bija is for Ganesh? We don't know. It's just that some rishi, it was revealed to them that way. That's why I say it's very esoteric, it's very mysterious, you can say, for us. But if we repeat those mantras, we will be able to understand if you whichever deity you're devoted to. So there are other mantras also that they are not bijas, but they also have no meaning. When you do prakshana, you say pat, that means it's to purify things. You drive away negative influences. Now, pat has no meaning per se. You're not saying, like in English, you would say, go away. That has a meaning. You're saying pat. And by that, you are driving away negative influences, or you could call them spirits or whatever. But, you know, we are surrounded by positive and negative influences. They are subtle. We cannot see them, but we can feel them. So there is a lot of... A good part of the puja in the beginning is clearing the atmosphere of negative influences. Somebody has come into the room who is not interested in this and maybe has come to do mischief. So get rid of these negative influences. Or, I don't know, you know, some influence that we cannot pinpoint. Whatever it is, if we don't know what it is, we want to make sure that the atmosphere is clear. That is a positive atmosphere, that is a congenial atmosphere for the worship of God. Or, for instance, there is some impurity, and we didn't know about it. Somebody did something wrong in that room, but I don't know about it. So, to purify that, whatever happened there that I am not aware of, I am doing this. So there may be some impurity we are not aware of. Somebody did something when nobody was watching. So like that, that's a big part of puja in the beginning, to create a positive atmosphere and to protect also from negative influences. Yes?
Every chakra has a lotus and every petal of the lotus has a beat sound.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a connection?
I don't know about the each petal having a sound. That is the first time I hear it. I mean, must be true, but I just don't know about it.
Well, the bead sounds
for each petal. Yeah.
At least each chakra has some
bead sounds. Yeah. That. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I know the names of the lotuses, but I don't know in detail about that. Yeah.
I heard lotus represents the blooming of consciousness.
Yes. Yes, that's what Ramakrishna says.
It blooms. It's even though the stem comes from the muddy waters, mm-hmm. It's up on the top of the water with the purity, mm-hmm. And then it opens up with the sun's rays and becomes, it's open to knowledge and wisdom. That's mm-hmm. what I heard.
Yes, it is true. It is true. That is what Sri Ramakrishna experienced these things. He saw... the kundalini rising and the lotuses that had been drooping becomes upright and open, and he becomes illumined progressively as the kundalini rises.
And it's also symbolic of, like, even though we come from some muddy stuff, or mind is all muddy, and then you can still be pure if you come, just like the lotus stem, mm-hmm. comes up to the top. That's right. Mm-hmm.
True. Yeah.
Swami Vivekananda speaks in one of his lectures about beings with different vibrations.
Yes.
From us, and we can't see them. Mm-hmm. Would you say those are equivalent to the positive and negative influences?
Not necessarily. We were talking yesterday about the power of thought. And how, you know, negative thoughts and positive thoughts have an influence on us. So it could be what you say, what Swami Vivekananda said, or it could be just negative influence from other human beings. But it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell what it is referring to. But certainly we feel some places, like you come to a holy place and you feel somehow true, it is true. Elevating, and other places is somehow pulling you down. We can feel that.
That's true. But I also think of, like, sometimes murderers say that voices told them to do it.
Yes, yes, yes. No, it is possible. We just don't know.
Since
Swami Vivekananda said it, we believe it. You know, that he said that we are going through, we may be going through many beings in our daily lives, and we don't see them and they don't see us. It's perfectly possible, Swamiji said. But because we are in a different state of vibration, different dimensions, you can say, but at the same time, they overlap. There is some overlapping. It's hard to really understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
difficult. Yes.
So, can you show us some of the mudras for the Nitya Puja?
For the which?
The Nitya?
Nitya Puja. Yes. You see, the mudras, they go together. So, for instance, you have a mudra, you are going to offer fruit, and then you do like this. That means, I am protecting it. Then you do like this. I am sanctifying it. Then you do like this. And you say, om, 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 10 times, and like this. That's also part of the purification, and then you offer. These are very simple mudras, but they go together. You cannot just do one; it's like a sequence, you can say. But there is a book on that, and you know you can you have to sit with somebody. I mean, I'm just showing you, but this is something that you can do when you are offering something to God. Then. You, for instance, you repeat the name of God and say, for instance, Om Ramakrishna, 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 Om Ramakrishna. So you are purifying your senses. For instance, this is done with these three fingers. You know, Om Ram. So it's certain fingers are used. So you have to learn it. That's why I said it's better to learn it properly or not do it. Because if I'm going to use all my fingers and, that's better not do it. That is my thing. But this is not rocket science. Anybody can learn it. It's a matter of... Because I was pujari, I was doing it daily, so I don't have a problem, but... Then you say, Om Ramakrishna. Om Sri Ramakrishna Namaha. Like that, you're purifying your whole body. While repeating the mantra, and you're imagining that your whole body is being purified. So this, it may take, a couple of minutes only, add a couple of minutes to your worship, but it gives another dimension. Before offering, you're purifying yourself, and you're purifying the items. Yeah.
I just wanted to share, instead of the book and the...
Yes.
Growing up in that culture, we were taught that any object associated with learning is goddess of Saraswati.
Yes.
Piece of paper, pen,
yes.
And it's become, we don't keep the book on the foot end of the bed, and now it's become so ingrained that even if by accident, something, we just,
Yes. It is true. It is true.
But like you said, everything is Prabhupada, right? It's all matter.
Yes. Yeah, well, especially the Western culture, it's matter. It's what's the difference?
This is a question from a friend of mine. That do negative energies of people affect you?
Like I think
in India they have this black dot they put on baby.
Yes.
The negative thoughts away, or maybe somebody's too. Jealous of your child, beautiful child. So
well,
is that something?
There is a story. It's kind of scary that when Swami Vivekananda was in his wanderings, he came across a yogi, and in the Himalayas, and the followers of the yogi became attracted to Swami Vivekananda, and this yogi who had psychic powers. Thought that Vivekananda deliberately was taking his disciples away and cursed him. And Swami Vivekananda felt terribly ill. And then he said, what is the power of the avatar if he cannot protect me from this yogi, this ordinary yogi with psychic powers? And Sri Ramakrishna said something to the effect like, look, the laws have to be respected. He has psychic powers, they work. Something like that. I don't remember exactly what Sri Ramakrishna said, but it was something like that. But the main thing is, Swami Vivekananda, so powerful, he was affected by the curse and fell ill. So I believe it, yes. It's kind of scary, but yes, we are all affected by good and evil. We are all connected. So we have to be kind to everybody.
It seems to curse someone like Vivekananda would be really bad karma. I mean,
it probably was. It probably was. Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine. I can imagine that. Yes. But somehow it hit him. It had an effect.
Yeah. Even in the Puranas, the Rakshasa had some special powers that they used against the Devas.
Yes. 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 Of course, these people who are trying to, you know, hurt other people, they are hurting themselves. It's a matter of time until the boomerang comes back.
But that's
no, of course not. Of course not. But yes, I think it works.
We have an lighter rain, sorry. We have an example of Bhasmasura who praised Lord Shiva for a boon that nobody will be, anybody he puts a hand on their head, they should be destroyed. Ash. And then when the god gives this wish, boon, and then he in turn, he wanted to test it on Shiva himself. So he turns around and he chases him to put his hand on his head. Then Shiva goes and prays all the other gods. Then Vishnu becomes a Mohini action, and he dances and dances, and he makes him delusional, the Bhasmasura. And then when Vishnu puts his head while dancing, his hands on the head, and the Bhasmasura puts his hands on, and he becomes the ash. End of the story.
Yes.
He creates his own destruction. That's what, you know, even in our daily lives, a lot of times people do that.
Yeah.
They create their own destruction.
Yeah.
They can empower others, or they can create their own destruction.
True.
This is one of the stories our parents told us when we were growing up.
Mm-hmm. So many years ago when I was in practice, one of the Indian parents bought a baby a couple of weeks old with a, you know, with a So some of the American nurses, they were stunned. They said they're putting makeup on a 2 week old. They were ready to call child welfare. This was the days before the
right.
release.
Yes. Oh my. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. Yes, please. Yes.
To me, it reminds me a little bit scientific way of thinking that when you understand the power of the electricity. You know, it has positive and negative currents. As a human being, we also understand that. And so, it's, to me, when it's both are connected properly, then it becomes equal, balanced out. And then it functions. Otherwise, it does not function at all. If neither of them connected, then it will not function. So, same way, we understand in like Chinese sense or Indian sense, the positive, negative forces works within us too. And if you get up in the morning and you think, oh, it doesn't feel good, it's all night, it's gloomy, whatever. During the day, you just feel at the end of the day, really exhausted and tired. So I think positive, negative definitely has impact on us. And so has something to do with that. When you talk about the worship, your mindset works, and then you create that positive energy. That's what I think.
Very good.
Maharaj, you mentioned about Swami Ramakrishnanandaji fanning Guru Maharaj's picture, and you also mentioned about that you were a pujari before. So when Swami Ramakrishnanandaji was doing that, he must have been doing it very sincerely. He must be doing very this way, not turning here and there, and thinking of something else. And when you also do puja, so some things might be like a mechanical action, but how do you develop your internal attitude, like how to really feel, get connected and do it?
Yeah, that's a big challenge when you are doing puja daily for a long time, because being pujari involves... you are in the temple from... You open the temple in the morning and you close it at night and you do so many things during the day. So this is the biggest challenge, that to watch that it doesn't become mechanical, that you're not just doing it, you know, just as your job, thinking of something else. So I caught myself many times doing it mechanical. You know, you have to just be aware, catch yourself and bring the mind. There's nothing you can do about what the distraction you already undergone. You have undergone. You know, if your mind went away and wandered, there's nothing we can do. But we bring it back, and and start thinking of God. Excuse me. I think suppose I'm closing the windows in the shrine. I am opening the curtains in the shrine. You know, it's like doesn't require concentration. It's not like everybody's watching and I am performing arati, that I have to be very careful what I do. This is nobody's watching and I'm just closing the curtains. But still I have to be watchful. I have to do it for God and not for myself. Not just, it's not an ordinary curtain. I'm, you know, in God's house. So there is no answer. It's just practice. Like we said yesterday, abhyasa. Try again to keep the mind on God. But that is a big challenge. And when I see some priests doing puja, it's like everything is done like lightning speed. All the mantras are... and you don't even know what they say. I'm not criticizing, but it's just that I wonder sometimes at that speed, how much attention can one pay? Yes. And time is money. Time is money, you know. Yes.
And when they say something and we don't know, and we are supposed to repeat, but we're not familiar with the language.
Yes.
God knows what we are repeating.
But you know, this is what we were talking about earlier, the worship with desire. So the concern is that I'm doing this worship to get this result. I don't care whether it is done in 5 minutes or 5 hours. I want the result. So I trust the priest that he will do everything right, and that's all I need. I am in the priest's hands. So let him do it however quickly they want, and I'll get the result. That is because it's worship with desire.
I think that's also why Thakur made such a point of telling us to be tamasic devotees if necessary. No need for a priest. Just go directly to your parent and say, listen, am I your 8-month child? Am I a castaway? Or am I your own? And just ask for what you want. Demand what you want. No need to have an intermediary. No need. All of the great teachers have told us over and over. Chaitanya, no times are set, no rites are needful for chanting of thy name, so vast is thy mercy. Christ said, come to me, ye who are heavy laden, and I will give you this. You know, this priestcraft is, I'm not condemning it, but as Swami Vivekananda said, it's a frail boat. It's a frail boat. It's not going to get us necessarily across the ocean.
True.
It is incredible that Thakur was giving gifts to everybody, and he said, like a child demand of God what you need. To me, it was very incredible that with the cancer that was so painful, he never asked Makali for suffer from it.
Yes. That's true. But you know why? He said, in a different context, not when he was sick, but I think it gives an insight. He said, there are two persons here, meaning himself. One is the mother, and the other one is the child, the devotee. It is the devotee that broke his arm, but it's also the mother. They're both inside, coexisting. So how can he ask the mother? The mother is in him. It's very strange that these two can coexist in the person of Sri Ramakrishna. He said very clearly, these two exist in me. One is the Divine Mother, and the other one is the child.
But that is also incredible.
Yeah.
That you are thinking the Divine Mother will protect you, and you are suffering so much, and yet you have nothing negative sentiment about a God that is supposed to protect you. Your mother, no less, is still putting you through so much suffering. You never questioned.
Yeah.
That was a lesson for all of us, not to question the ways of God.
Well, he said that the child misbehaved and the mother took the child on her lap and spanked him. And while the mother is spanking him, the child says, "Oh, Ma, Ma," asking mother for help. The mother is punishing. And he's saying, "Ma, help me." It's like for Sri Ramakrishna, there was nothing but mother. So he cannot complain. He's too close to mother to even complain about it. The closeness is
In my old home, when I was growing up, I saw both sides of puja. One from my grandmother, who used to be so perfect in rituals. And daily she would sit there for hours washing each god and putting chandan, cedar paste and all that. And I could identify when you say that for some reason, if she had to go out somewhere out of town, then the biggest discussion in our house, who will replace? Sometimes I was grafted. So I was in charge of that. So she would make sure that I know each and every step perfectly and I don't mess up anything. So I had to take training and I dreaded that day. Because if I do something wrong and she finds out, she will take me to task. And you have to take bath, of course, before performing anything. And particular silver sari, you must put that on. And when we are traveling, her gods and goddesses will get a special treatment ahead of her. They will be transferred before she is transferred. So that anybody who is in charge, they can do that and keep for her ready. And on the other hand, in my own house, my father's example, he was a perfect jnani. He couldn't care less for puja or anything. So I grew up between these two. And, I feel that I like puja because of the atmosphere it creates. That sound of ghanti, that bell, flowers, light, fragrance, incense. So it builds the environment.
Yes.
But I do believe that if you do not sit there, suppose you do all the rigmarole and all the steps, but if there is no pure devotion in your heart, faith, then it's just give me.
Right.
That's not right.
Right.
So I think there should be an integration of the jnana approach, why you are doing what you are doing, what is the ultimate purpose, realize God, or to transform your own nature, your character, how you treat others. And that grandmother was a hot-tempered woman.
Was it?
And that's how he never, but toward the end, she became a totally different person.
Mm-hmm.
After all, maybe after all that puja
had an effect.
In,
mm-hmm.
But she was a very kind, forgiving lady mm-hmm. at the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there is some hope.
Yes.
You keep looking.
Yes, yes, yes.
Assimilation of both paths
yes.
happened, and that was my biggest question: how can so many paths exist, and all of them swearing that it is true?
Yeah.
So who do I believe? So thanks to Radhakrishna's path, it shows us that every the Karma Yogi and the Bhakti Yogi and the Jnana Yogi, they all towards the same goal.
Mm-hmm.
So of course you have to get your senses on focus before for Bhakti, which gets you to Jnana.
Mm-hmm. True. So, Brother Shankara, almost 12:30.
Well,
is it time for lunch?
I think it's definitely time for lunch. But first, I think two things need to be said. First, an expression of great gratitude.
Yes.
You're making time for us to travel here and spend your weekend with us, offering us all that you offer. We're so glad that you came. And the second thing, it's painful always to bring this up, but there is expense associated with this Swami coming here. And if you can help the center with that expense, that would be a kindness. So we are so grateful for your coming, Maharaj, and the Swami's expenses, of course, have been paid. So thank you for coming, Swami.
Okay, thank you for having me. I had a very nice visit. Thank you. Yeah, sure.
Yes, we'll ask the Swami again. Oh, yes. Uma has asked me to do the closing prayer. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. Jai Shri Guru Maharaj.